There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 783. Let's go over to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. I know how to say that. Nerdist Community Corkboard. First off, this person did not write his name, but he has a friend named Matt Parker, who is releasing his second jazz album entitled Present Time Today. He says, Matt and I have known each other for over 20 years, and I know he continues to put his heart and soul into the music he writes and performs. The best way to describe Matt is that he is Farley-esque in his demeanor. He's an extremely kind and caring family man who has struggled, as many do, in the music business. Last year was a big year for him as he was involved in the movie John Wick with Keanu Reeves. He's playing in the jazz band during the hotel bar scene, and you can pre-order his album now, mattparkermusic.com. Also, if you're going to be in New York City, don't miss the album release show on Thursday, February 11th at 7 p.m. at National Sawdust, which is 80 North 6th Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11249. Thank you for including the zip code, man with no name. You're a good friend to Matt Parker. Person. Also, this is kind of a big announcement for a very long time. Listen, I know how I have always been about sports. I know. You know, I was very dismissive of it, you know, because it's not like I was good at it in school. And I was into all of the things that were not sports. I excelled at all of those things. So I developed a hatred for it because I don't understand it. And I used to shit on it all the time. And I shit on it a little bit in this podcast because they preempted the X-Files with football. But that's a specific story that I think you would back me up on. But then when we started doing the podcast, I came to understand that there was a section of nerds who actually do appreciate sports. Fantasy sports, regular sports, stats, numbers. And so it broadened my horizons, and, you know, I was being the same kind of elitist douchebag that sports people were to me when I was growing up, and that's no good to be the same way. So a man named Jonah Carey, who used to work for Grantland, comes on the podcast a while back. We become friends. He's incredibly smart, incredibly nerdy about life, pop culture, and sports. And then Grantland goes away, and not that long ago, I get a call from Jonah Carey saying, what do you think about Nerdist Sports? And I said, God damn it. Yeah. I mean, just the right person hasn't come along to do it. You may be the right person, Jonah Carey. So, premiering January 29th, right here on Nerdist, the Jonah Carey podcast. Interviewing athletes, comedians, celebrities about sports and more. I may even pop up on one. It'll be every Friday right here on Nerdist, and maybe we'll get him to blog and actually cover some sports stuff from the kind of nerd-centric point of view, because Jonah excels at that. He's the real deal, and he's a good dude. He's a kind dude. He's not aggressive. I didn't want to get an aggressive sports dude in here. He's a cool, nerdy sports dude. So I welcome you, Jonah Carey, publicly and officially to the Nerdist Podcast Network, starting Friday, January 29th. Thank you so much. I hope you all enjoy it. You will. Because Jonah's a terrific, terrific guy. This episode, David Duchovny promoting a show called X-Files, which you may have heard of, which is back, at least part of it was, when it aired on Fox. Thanks, football after show. There shouldn't be after shows on television unless they're about shows that I'm hosting. But no post-show sports talk if it's jutting into X-Files. But the regular time slot will be Mondays at 8 p.m. Pacific and Eastern time on Fox. David Duchovny was fantastic, as you will hear in this interview. We'll get to it in a moment. You know, I do want to point this out, too. When Gillian Anderson was on, she drew a big vagina in the book because Clive Barker and a few other people drew dongs, and so Gillian Anderson drew a giant vagina in the book. David Duchovny signed that vagina today. So they were united in the Chewbacca, the Nerdist Chewbacca Wookiee book that has all of the podcast signatures in it. I am more delighted about that than you could possibly imagine, and you should be too. Here is the Nerdist Podcast, number 783, with David Duchovny. Katie, the thing is out there. Roll it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You do it?
I lucked out with all of my flight booking. I had the 9:25 flight last night, and it was like the second flight to leave JFK of the day. God. American just canceled all their flights, but Delta really hung in.
I was supposed to do shows there all weekend, and I was like, I don't think I should go. And
no,
then they canceled them.
You were right to not go.
And then people were like, it hasn't even started snowing yet. And then apocalyptic ice forest.
The forecast changed a bunch, and we were in Midtown, and they said we're going to get maybe 8 inches.
You can say that's the way I drink.
Duchovny was nice. He just requested a bowl of water, and that was it. I'm surprised you made it back this early, actually. I thought it would be like a day or two more.
I was pretty stoked. Right, it took 25 and a half minutes to get from 50th Street to JFK in a cab.
Because
no one was on the road. It was amazing. Everyone should have that.
Anyway, it was like 65 degrees here yesterday. I had to wear a light jacket. It was really upsetting. It's cold for Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Did you just come from your star on the Walk of Fame ceremony?
Yeah, isn't that what one does?
That's sort of a daily routine.
Yeah.
We
can do it again tomorrow if you like.
Yes, would you please go get another star and then come back?
Yeah, get one for radio.
Yeah, like... Well, this will be the cause for that. We'll do such an amazing...
this podcast. No choice.
They'll have to give me
Fox will have
tomorrow.
No choice.
They're going to start giving out podcast stars,
exactly.
I think, on the Walk of Fame.
And what will that look? What will the insignia
an
look
iPod.
Like?
It'll just be an old iPod.
It'll look like a microphone, but it'll kind of look like a dong. So it'll be, and it won't be on Hollywood Boulevard. It'll be like... You have to be like in an alley off Argyle
it'll
or
be
somewhere.
Right off Robertson in the 10th.
Podcast Walk of Fame. Saddest thing ever.
Way over.
You can't actually walk.
No.
By it.
You know, Culver City's very nice. It's right near the courthouse across from the gas station. It's like right there, right in front of that mobile station.
Right.
Thank you for doing the podcast, and congratulations on the star.
Thank
and congratulations
you.
On X-Files, and it's... Listen, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they preempted like 20 minutes of the show last night with football.
Well, yeah. I mean, football, you don't know when it's going to end exactly, so it's hard for them to...
No, fuck that. It should have been over. It should have been over.
You got to hear the breakdown.
No, you don't have to hear the breakdown.
Hear the breakdown.
The internet is the breakdown.
Well, actually, the post game show was completely useless. I don't know if you tuned in. Well,
no, I don't understand football.
Yeah, well, the post game show is meaningless and unnecessary. And then that happened after. If they had just cut the post game show, they probably could have started the show on time. But
it felt to me. Uh-huh. Like
you were insulted.
I was like it felt to me like a douchey older jock brother's like, hey, sorry, I taped 20 minutes over your nerd show. Fuck you. You know, it's like it just felt so like, are you serious?
Yeah.
I feel like we're waiting like 13 years. What the why tonight?
Well, you didn't miss it, did you?
No, I watched it.
Right.
I watched it.
It's like John McNamara, who's a show running Aquarius show I'm doing now. He said, I can't believe it. The football guys ruined my life in high school.
They continue.
Right.
It's just like an unnecessary TV wedgie for everyone. But it was great, and it was so it was so great to see the. Because I guess in my mind I thought, oh, are they gonna what's the new opening sequence gonna be? Are they gonna update? And it's exactly the same.
It's exactly the same.
Well, 16:9.
It just all right, Matt. You know,
all right. It's one of those
slightly
guys.
Different.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, he is one of those
different.
Guys.
I'm not talking to him.
Join the club.
It's like your chair just kind of swiveled. The body language just sort of iced him out a little bit. He's just back over in the corner there.
He's got a conspiracy idea. I know he does.
I mean, it...
Yeah, well, it saves money, too, to do the... I mean, it's a win-win credit sequence.
It is. It really is. We already have it. You might as well just tack it on.
Why not? And it's the kind of thing where an actor, you hate shooting a credit sequence. You're like, fuck it. I don't want to shoot a... I'm working hard. I'm doing the show. You want me to fucking go shoot a credit sequence now?
Can't you just take footage from the show?
I gotta fall into a handprint.
Which they shot in real time, right? Like they dropped you.
That was a good day.
That was a really good
fall
day.
Fall into a handprint.
It's like I'm looking at my call sheet. Mulder falls into handprint.
What?
Oh, it's the credit sequence. Oh, cool.
Ah, damn all right. It. All right. I guess I'm going to.
That'll be fantastic because everybody tunes in for a credit sequence.
But you know what, though? In a way, you do because probably like 10 years ago, I was watching, and I had watched the original run, but, you know, FX was running X-Files every night. So it was just one of those things. Like when I would get into bed, I would turn on X-Files, and it was just. And the credit sequence, as 90s as it was so comforting to me. Mm-hmm. And the everything about it was just so it just felt so, so
listen,
nice.
When I watch Cheers on Netflix, I don't skip that. I let that whole song play
every time.
Every time.
I'm liking you more now. So the thing is, like, you know, like Modern Family's credit sequence is 5 seconds long. I think what's good about a credit sequence is it's like the show starts, you get ready, mm-hmm. and then the teaser ends, the credit sequence starts, and you know you can run and go take a piss or get some food.
Right.
And you want a good, healthy credit sequence that allows you to go do those things.
Yeah, and you know, it's just that attention spans are so short now that networks are like, oh, we can't let it we can't for like 2 seconds.
Well, it's like when you watch The Simpsons and they do the short one or the long one. When they do the short one, you're like, this is packed with jokes.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you go back and watch like 70s television, there are like 3-minute credit sequences that explain the entire plot of the show.
Or, you know, if you sit through movies now, credit sequences are it's a big question because when I directed a movie, I got some good advice from a director. He said, you know, you've got like 8 minutes to grab them. You know, they're sitting in their seats. They came here to care about something. They didn't pay money because they don't want to care.
Right.
They do. They came out because they want to take a ride with the story. But if you fuck around with like an 8-minute credit sequence, you're pushing it. Then you got 1 minute to catch them.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like
James Bond has earned it. They can do that. That's it.
Well, because people now enjoy that. And I think what you're saying is like the X-Files credit sequence is something. It's just something in and of itself that people dig, I guess. I don't know.
It's its own thing. It's kind of its own
thing. It's like when they get the music. Like they love the music. Oh, the music. I'm like, yeah, fuck the music. The music made the show. Yes. Yes. The show's a hit because of boop, 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 boop. That's why it's a hit, people.
I tune in for
that. That's exactly right.
Beautiful shots of Vancouver.
Yes. That made it a hit. Yes. True.
What was the episode
true
about?
Story.
I think he was falling into a handprint.
Yeah.
I don't know. It
was fantastic.
Mesmerized.
And that song. I have to see that song on TV every week.
I mean, I wonder if Chris Carter did the Gene Roddenberry thing of like, I'm going to write lyrics to this so I get a share of this.
No, here's the truth is Chris went to Mark Snow, who is the composer who did that theme. And he said, it has to be a spooky theme that you could whistle around a campfire. It has to get in your head and it has to stay in there forever. And they fooled around with stuff and it actually became like whistling.
Yeah.
It was like that was the whistling. And so he was right. I mean, he, whatever the assignment was to make like an earworm, he did it.
Yeah.
And then Mark Snow, I was going on the Rosie O'Donnell show, and that's a long time ago.
Yeah, that's,
I mean,
yeah, there you
was,
go.
There was a Rosie O'Donnell show.
That's when she was still in love with Tom Cruise.
Possibly. I wasn't aware of that relationship. But so I don't know much of what's going on. So, I was, for some reason, Rosie really loved the music. It was something that we were going to talk about, the music. And so I called Mark Snow and I said, I'm going to go on the show and Rosie loves the music. Are there lyrics to that song? Did you ever, were there lyrics to it? And he goes, yeah, it's, these are lyrics. He goes, and his name is Mark Snow. He goes, lyrics to that tune are, the X-Files is a show. with music by Mark Snow. The Eggs Found. Those are the lyrics.
That's actually not far off from what I would sing when it would come on, which is just X-Files. And somewhere online, someone has probably clipped that on YouTube and it probably has like 5 million views. Like,
well,
people
I think
it.
You should, from now on, if you watch the show at home, you should sing along the Mark Snow, you know, top shelf lyrics.
X-Files is a show. What is it?
With music by Mark Snow. Snow.
Yeah.
God, I hope a Korean karaoke company is listening right now.
I would love someone to karaoke that song. It'd just be like a 30-second karaoke and then they're done.
Right.
That's what you need to do. That's what you need to do. Do you did it feel like, is it one of those things where it just like, oh, this just felt like where we left off? And I just picked it right back up, but just we just slid right back in.
Yes and no. I think mostly yes. I think we kind of know what we're doing with that show, and but still, we'd been away a while, you know, since 2008. So it wasn't really as long as people think, because they think it's from when the TV show ended, which was 13 years ago or almost 14. But really, it's only been like 5 or 6
movie,
years.
Yeah.
So it's less weird, I think, because we had done that. But still a little weird and a little creaky, but you know, every job that you do is creaky in the beginning. It's like, it's just like that. So we want to rediscover it anyway for ourselves. You know, we want to make it, we don't want to just be doing something else. So in a way, it was nice to just make it fresh. It was fresh because we've been away so long.
Yeah. I mean, 1992, 93, all of a sudden you start working a bunch and you're on these two shows at the same time. Which at the time was relatively unprecedented. Like, that was a time when networks were like, we own you.
Yeah, yeah.
You cannot do, it's changed now, but you cannot do anything else.
Right.
But here you are on this Showtime show, and then, and I always, I'm talking about the Red Shoe Diaries also with it. And I always, like, after I got into, because I watch both shows, I always imagined that they were connected and that the narrator was actually what Mulder did in his free time on Retro Diaries. Yeah. He was like, yeah, I'm going to go solve some X-Files, but then I'm going to go read some sexy stories where people have sex on a pool table in a fog machine.
Because Mulder
store.
Was sexless. So he had to,
that was his.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're both characters definitely felt like there was something missing in their lives, that, like, emotionally.
Well, one had a dog, and and the other had Scully. You know, so.
But what
and
was,
I'm not saying which had which.
No, you don't have to say.
That'll be a spoiler.
No, I don't want to spoil it for people.
Yeah.
But what was the? I mean, I imagine that show was probably just you shooting wraparounds. Like, you just go in and shoot wraparounds.
Yeah, it was
then,
so much. It was cool for me as a young actor, because we and this is going to sound really just petty and venal, and I'm just going to say it anyway.
Please.
Because nobody listens to your show, right?
No. Okay. This is just
it's not like this could actually get out.
No, anyway. This is just for us.
Yeah, just for us.
Yeah.
But I would get paid by the episode.
Yeah.
As you do in television. And even though I would do like, I could do 5 episodes of Red Shoe Diaries. I remember coming down from Vancouver, where we were shooting the first year of the X-Files, to do like 5 episodes of Red Shoe Diaries in one day on a Saturday, and then fly back up to Vancouver on a Sunday. So I was just so pleased with myself. And I remember calling it my Jack Nicholson day, because I was going to make like as much money as Nicholson makes in an hour.
Yeah.
I was going to make for those 5 episodes. And I was like, yeah, putting it over on the man.
Well, that is it. I mean, especially when you're an actor and you don't know, because you could go another 2 years without working. And
exactly.
you really do have to hoard as much as you can, because you just never know when that's going to go away.
You don't know. You still don't know. I mean, so it's a freelance job. And it's a lot like being an athlete. You know, you can have a very lucrative career, but it can also be very short.
Yeah.
You just don't know how long it lasts.
How long were you in X-Files before you felt like, oh, you know, this actually I think is...
I could buy a car, maybe.
this is actually a thing that is, might be around for a while.
Probably the second or third year, maybe at the end of the second year.
Yeah.
Maybe really solidly in the third year when we started to do, like, it occurred to me, and I could see that the shows that we were doing were just big TV shows, that it wasn't just this niche sci-fi show, that we're kind of making movies every week. And it was like, well, we're doing something different from other television that I saw. This was before cable really ascended and with really high quality stuff, you know. So for a network to be putting out that kind of a production every week was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that was real. Well, back then, at that time, Fox really had to prove itself as a network. They were still relatively young, and they really had, they had Married with Children, and they had The Simpsons.
Right, exactly.
In the 80s, and then, like, the 90s, like, they really kind of needed hit shows to, you know. God, that was right around the time where people stopped going, oh, I think it's not like a joke network. I think it's like a real network.
I think they had Beverly Hills, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
90210. And they had Melrose Place, you know, and then they had us, and then... I don't know what's happened since, to be honest with you. But...
Nothing else.
Not a ton. They still have The Simpsons.
They still have X-Files. Yeah.
Well, you know, if it ain't broke.
They just got to bring back Married with Children now. I think they have all...
Well, I think Ed's busy.
He's a little busy right now. Yeah. I don't know if he'd be able to... I mean, it is, you know, when you look at performers, even just getting on one hit show... Because you also with Californication too, it's like one hit show is crazy. We're like, wow, this is you're in like the upper 0.1%.
Right.
But then you follow it up with another hit show. Then you kind of have to feel like, oh, maybe I kind of like. Do you feel like you kind of know what you're doing? Did you just feel like I don't know? I'm just
Yeah, I feel like I know what I'm doing. I don't feel like I know how I'm choosing or if I'm choosing the right show to. You know, like the next hit show, I don't know. I just kind of go with my gut. If I can see myself doing something, or I could see myself doing it for more than a year or whatever, something like that. But no, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing in the professional sense. I know what I'm doing when I get on set. I know what I'm doing as an actor. I know what I try to do. I know I keep learning. I know I keep trying to get better. So I kind of look at projects as, how's that going to help me, you know, do something new? How am I going to challenge myself in some weird way?
Because you were on Californication about as long as you were on the first run of the X-Files.
Yeah,
about
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, it just doesn't, for some reason, X-Files feels like that was on for like 20
forever.
Years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Californication, oh, that a good, no, that was 7 years.
I think because, you know, X-Files just syndicates, right? So it just seems like it never went away. But Californication is tough to syndicate. It's kind of dirty, you know, so it's hard. It can't really play on free TV. So, we used to talk about, like, at the end of the year, they'd say, oh, yeah, we got to go back and do the airplane version of the show. I'm like, this is going to take 7 days to re-loop all, to put all these, I got to say, Mother Trucker, every day, Mother Trucker. You know, it's like, it just didn't make sense. And they'd have to recut Sex and the City syndicates, but I don't think Californication will ever play on free television.
I mean, there was definitely more sex to cut around.
I don't see how it could. It would be like a very short version. Here's a 5-minute Californication.
This is about a writer who just has a bad day.
Like,
there's no...
And he's drunk, and he's passed out.
He never gets laid.
That was a great show. That was fun. I love that Evan Hamlet.
Did you develop that show?
No.
But you were a producer on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they came to me with the project and with the script. And Tom Kapanos had written, he was trying to do a show, and he had written this spec movie script, or like 70 pages of it. And it was his wife who said, you know, because Showtime wanted to work with Tom, and she said, why don't you give him that spec script about that writer, you know? And so he did, and they said, yeah, we'd love to do this as a series. So he turned it into a pilot. I got the pilot, and... It was right around the time I was coming off the X-Files a couple years earlier. And I was kind of frustrated that there was no comedies that I was seeing that I could do. You know, there was like no comedies that I could find to do in movies. I did Evolution. That did okay. But I couldn't really find, even that I was kind of a straight man. I really couldn't find my kind of comedy, like what I wanted to do. And Californication came closest to that, you know, because it was kind of, it harkened back to like the 70s and... movies like Shampoo or, you know, Harold and Maude, kind of adult humor.
Yeah.
Very ironic, very dark. And I thought, yeah, I can do that way better. They're not going to ask me to do Night at the Museum. They're not going to ask me to do Dumb and Dumber, even though I wanted to. You know, I wanted to be asked. But then it became clear to me that just I didn't have the persona or the look or whatever. It wasn't going to come my way, but I wanted to do comedy. And so... it was back on TV. That wasn't necessarily something I wanted to do, but I thought, okay, this is the, at least this is the kind of comedy I want to do. I don't care where it's going to be. We'll do it on TV again. I'll come back to TV and do it that way. So,
I mean, that's so strange. It's so funny to hear how. I mean, do you feel like you got pigeonholed in some ways? Because your appearances on Larry Sanders were pretty epic. And so I think from that, it's like, oh, well, clearly this guy can do comedy.
I think it's not so much that I can't do comedy. It's more like the kind of comedies that get done now, the kind of comedies that are popular now, the tone of the comedy. Especially at that time, it was more like Jim Carrey stuff and Ben Stiller stuff, which I love, but it's not me, and it's not what I do, and it's not what I can do. I couldn't even do it. So it wasn't the prevailing theatrical movie release comedy that was happening. I can't think of a comedy that maybe I could have been in that
Paul
time.
Blart Mall Cop?
Yeah. So I don't see me as Paul Blart Mall Cop.
No, David, think about it.
Well,
you're right, segue?
I like you as a producer. I've ridden a hoverboard.
You could be Randy Blart, his brother, his much more intense brother.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so you see where I'm going. So, yeah, so California Cajun Camp was like, okay, this is a, he's like a man among men. You know, I can see it. It felt like Shampoo to me. It felt like the 70s. So, you know, I'm sure we aired on the side of too much from time to time, but like the heart of the show was something that I was attracted to. Was that funny guy, funny-ish guy in that situation. That was for me.
Who was, you know, I mean, I'm sure part of the pitch was like, and every lady wants to hop on the sack with him. Like, that's an interesting idea, but he's deeply flawed. Like, that character, has serious problems.
Well, Tom, I when I got the script, I was like, okay, I love the pilot. It was very funny, but what's the show? I mean, is the show just sex then? Because I'm not interested in that. It's like, what's the comedy? What's leading us on? And he said, it's like, it's the relationship, it's the family. It's like, what if you got it right the first time and then screwed it up? And how do you get it back? How do you get back to happily ever after with the person that you're supposed to be with? You know, and I was like, okay, all right, I'll go along for that ride. Let's see where that goes. So that was kind of my intro into the world of the show. And then, you know, the other shenanigans just kind of, you know, that's what people focus on because sex sells, whatever, sex is shiny. You know, people, they're like dogs, you know, their ears, they hear sex and they go,
yeah.
And that's kind of what draws people. And, you know, Showtime and networks, they count on that with tits and ass, you know, and it gets people to watch. But for me, and I truly believe this, the show was always that, the heart of it was this family relationship, this relationship between Hank and Karen, between Hank and his daughter, between Hank and his agent, even a friendship. And that was really what made, for me, the foundation of the show and the reality of the show that I could dig into. And that was the show that I was wanting to make.
Do you think there's a good cautionary tale in there about, you know, midlife crisis dudes in their late 30s getting into their 40s of like trying to
nah.
Okay.
Nah. There's no cautionary tale in there because it always worked out for him. People come up to me on the street and say, hey dude, I am Hank Moody. I'm like, good luck, you know, so like, because you're not going to be able to smoke and drink and fuck around like that and get away with it because that's a television show.
It's not real.
Yeah,
it's not real.
It's not going to end well, buddy.
Yeah,
it's really not going to end.
Neither one of those is. It's not real.
Right, right.
Well, but that's the, you know, I think that's sort of the thing though is I think people, our generation and of course the next generation, you know, we're granted this extended adolescence that our parents didn't get.
Right.
You know, our parents were adults by the time they were seven, they were working in a factory
and
they
already
had three kids.
They were in the army.
They were in the army and they lived on food stamps.
Yeah.
But they you know, like when my parents were like 25, they were already adults and they had babies young. They had babies and now 25 is like, "Oh, you're a kid. You don't have to do anything for a long time." And it feels like
it is pretty fascinating. You know, the concept of childhood is relatively recent in human history, you know, because kids, even go back beyond the previous generation, kids from the Industrial Revolution on, they had to go to work at 8 or 9. They had to go to the factory. There was no childhood. So the concept of childhood, it does keep expanding, but it's relatively new. We take it for granted. But it's kind of a new development in human history that there's this thing, this inviolate kind of beautiful space that's supposed to have created for children, which they have this kind of blissful innocence.
Yeah.
And it's a nice idea, I think, but not past 19 or 20.
I just hope, because I just remember being younger and I would see dudes who are the age I am now and I'd be like, what are you doing? Right. Stop acting like that, you know, like just be more appropriate. But now I'm this age and I don't feel like I need to really hunker down. So I don't know if I'm making, you know, good choices or bad choices. I don't know. It's weird when you become that age.
I don't think, yeah, it's hard to know. You know, I think you just have to make choices from some sense of integrity, you know, some sense of honor and integrity somewhere inside you that you're, you know, it's something that you make up, your own moral code or whatever it is. But, you know, I'm sure you're making some good choices.
There are some decent choices. There have been some good choices.
You're in a nice room.
This is a great brick room. with a nice carpet that we put down to absorb the sound.
You're doing all right.
Yeah, things okay. I just mean, like, you always feel like yourself. You always feel like the same
age. Yeah.
You always feel like the same age. And my ex-girlfriend had a grandmother who lived well into her 90s, and she would say things that were terrifying. She would go, you know, in my head, I still feel like the same person I always was, but I look in the mirror and I don't recognize this person.
My father would say that to me. Yeah, said the exact same thing. He said, when I pass the mirror, I expect to see a 16-year-old.
Did that freak you out, or were you like, yeah, that's just what happens?
Well, before it's happened to you, yeah, you're like, yeah, deal with it.
Shut up, old man.
Yeah, come on. So you're old.
I got a lot of boners to deal with.
Have
Get
fun.
Up
yeah. Yeah. No, I think at some point you have an image of yourself physically, I guess, or even spiritually, mentally, and, you know, but time marches on, so, yeah. I don't know what to tell
you. Our generation's much more health conscious, though, than the previous generation didn't really. They sort of lived like madmen through most of their lives. But I think now people are more like, yeah, maybe don't drink everything and eat everything and maybe exercise a little bit and plan ahead.
Yeah, my mother was pretty much on the vanguard. We had yogurt for dessert.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was like yogurt. But she was an early health food person, Meg Duchovny.
I mean, your mother was Scottish, right?
She is Scottish.
She is Scottish. Yeah. She renounced.
They don't take that away, Chris.
Well, they almost seceded from the European.
There was a second where it almost happened.
Great Britain.
Yeah. Yeah. But then no.
Yeah.
So she's actually from Scotland.
You know, she would say that, and it's weird. She is actually Scottish, but oddly, her parents came, and this is true. This shows the economic savvy of my forebears. They came from post-World War I ravaged Great Britain and came to America for the Depression. Had three children and then moved back right as the Depression was lifting in America to go enjoy it again. In Great Britain.
They just felt comfortable that way.
So my mother, of all people, who really identifies herself as Scottish, was born in Queens, New York.
Oh, wow.
Was actually born in Queens. But when she was two or three, they went back to Scotland.
And then your dad
Then they met in Europe after World War II. They met in Rome or Paris. I can't remember which one. They fell in love and married and moved back to the States with my dad, who was from Brooklyn.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So,
so you grew up in New York.
I grew up in New York, yeah.
I didn't know this about you, and I did a little research. You have a master's degree, and you almost have a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
What's holding you back?
It's a little thing called a dissertation. It's a little book-length paper called a dissertation. I was in a PhD program. I'm not sure if I'm awarded a master's. I do have a master's. I don't know if I ever got awarded it because I was in a PhD program where they don't expect you to quit. They expect you to get a PhD, so they wouldn't award you a master's along the way. Mm. So I did all my work except for the paper, except for the dissertation. So I did my master's work and I did my orals and I taught my courses, and I didn't write the paper.
Now, this was at Yale, correct?
That was at Yale.
So does it ever sit in the back of your head and go, God, you know, maybe I should just take like 6 months and just bang it out and get the fucking PhD and be Dr. Duchovny?
Yeah, I think about that all the time, but I think it 6 months is not enough. I don't know if I could do it in 6 months. I'm also not sure if there's a statute of limitations on my schoolwork. Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't really ever investigated that. I've been waiting for the honorary degree. I will take that.
I mean, at this point.
I'll take a doctor of letters, whatever they give you when they give you an honorary degree.
And will you feel like, will the completionist part of your brain be satisfied at the point? Okay, good, I got it.
No, it's all bullshit. But, you know, if it had been, it really would have taken another year of my life at that time. And I just didn't. I just knew that I didn't want to be a professor, and I felt like I was getting old, not getting old, but getting older, and there were other things that I wanted to do, and I'd been in school my entire life at that point, and I was 25 or 26, and I just thought, you know, I keep on doing these things that are taking me down this road, and I want to get off this road, you know, so that was... I just kind of jumped. I never even told anybody that I wasn't going to write it. I mean,
you just stopped showing up one day.
I hope that my professors don't listen to your podcast.
No, this is just for us.
I think that they're probably expecting me to show up again at any moment.
There's some poor professor who can't die because he's like, oh, he's going to come in. I don't know why I made
him
weird,
an accent.
European. I don't know. I just,
so because,
you know why? Do you want to know why?
Yeah.
I will give you the matrix code behind my thought because I know that your PhD was going to have something to do with poetry. Mm. So I assumed this was like a European professor.
No.
Okay.
It was English literature, so no, he didn't have an accent.
Why are you racist against me, David Duchovny? I am not from here. I just became
that
something
was a
totally different
accent.
Yeah, well, he's very versatile,
he's
this
guy.
Professor.
You started
yeah.
Italian, and now you're.
Hey, what's the problem?
Oh, now that's just racist.
No, you're
no
a
one
racist.
Actually has that accent.
No, fuck you. But it is. I mean, when what do you have to like? What is a 300-page dissertation about poetry have to be like? What do you have to express in a PhD?
And does it have to be in rhyming couplet?
Oh my God! You're the whole thing.
No, doesn't have to rhyme. It has to basically be a book of criticism. And in order to sit my orals, which was a nerve-wracking experience. It's basically like sitting in front of a tribunal of experts. On their particular field, they know everything, and you are coming in. There's 6 to 8 of them, and you're responsible for, I think, 10 of 13 possible subjects. For instance, Shakespeare, 19th century novel, 20th century American poetry. So there are these big areas that you can be responsible for. I remember I didn't want Chaucer, so that was one I couldn't do. I didn't want to do medieval poetry, it was two. So I added like 10 out of the next 11 I had to be responsible for. And this guy is sitting, he was going to ask me questions, that's his field. Like each of these guys is a total expert in a field that I'm trying to front my way through in this 90-minute conversation, oral examination in front of these Yale professors. That I would have studied all semester for. While I'm teaching there, I'm just filling in all the gaps in my education. I'm reading everything that I didn't read in these areas that I'm going to be tested on because the people that are testing me know everything.
Yeah.
And they're going to catch me out. They can if they want.
You can't bullshit your way through that.
Well, no, they tell you. You know, they tell you like the gamesmanship is when you start talking. Do not stop talking. Make them stop you because it's a time thing. It's like 90 minutes. So if you filibuster, basically, good question. But Shakespeare, you know, because I know Shakespeare. So I'm going to just go. Let me talk for 45 minutes.
No hands until the end. I'll run it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there was some gamesmanship involved in it. But I remember making one huge mistake that I didn't know until later, until maybe a year later. I didn't figure it out. But they didn't call me on it. But it's totally nerve-wracking because you go in knowing they could kill you if they wanted to.
Sure.
You know, they don't really. I mean, it's not in their best interest. I mean, unless you're a real idiot and you're just not ready.
Do you remember the mistake?
Yeah.
What was it?
I remember I was talking about T.S. Eliot's plays, of all things, which I don't really know. I didn't know then. But I was spinning some kind of baloney about petrol being the English word for gasoline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about petrol and energy and something and this and that. And then later on, I found out that petrol is a bird. It's a type of bird.
Which is British for a lady.
So I was completely, it was completely wrong.
And they didn't call you on it.
No, they didn't. They might not have even, he might not have even been aware of that particular passage that I was referring to. But I remember when I found out, it was like one of those like white hot sweats that you get when you realize I said the wrong thing to the wrong person.
I mean, once you've done that, I would imagine the auditioning process is probably not as grueling once you've had that kind of a
trial.
It's
a different animal, you know, so it is grueling. I haven't had to audition in so long. I don't really remember, but auditioning is grueling, you know. That's a different thing because, you know, I used to go in thinking they wanted to hate me because I guess that's my nature, you know. I was like, they probably want to hate me. And then when I finally got on the other side of it, when I was directing, I wanted to love everybody that came in because I wanted to cast them. Mm. I wanted my job to be done. I wanted to find the guy or the girl. I wanted to find them. And so that really turned me around. When I directed, I was like, no, it's actually they want you to be great because they don't want to keep looking.
Right.
You know, whereas I used to go in thinking, oh, I'm wasting their time. And actors would come in and read for me, and they would be so apologetic and self-defeating. And they'd be like, oh, this is going to be really bad. I didn't really get this to like 9 o'clock last night, and I have a stomach ache. Anyway, so you want to even do it? Should we do it?
Should I leave? You don't want me to.
I could go. And I would sit there and I go, you worked on it. You took an hour to get here. You took the subway. You got to take an hour to take the subway back, you know, like honor yourself and like, let's, you know, you put the time in. So respect yourself and don't come in telling me you suck, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is the, it's it.
But I understand it from my own point of view. I used to walk in like that too. Like, oh, this is going to be bad. Guys, prepare to watch this.
What was the X-Files audition?
That would have been like a number of different auditions. One was for Randy Stone, who passed away. He was a great casting director, and for him and Chris. And then after that, they decided to bring me to the network, and then you have to pass the network. And that's really the nerve-wracking one, when you have to have your network audition as an actor going for a television show. Because it's basically a room like this that does not feel like a stage or anything at all.
Yeah.
And it's as many people as this in a small room like this, and you're acting the scene, and I really did feel like they wanted to hate me.
Well, but the network testing process is so shitty and brutal, and I always thought it's probably easier with a drama, because when you're testing for a sitcom, there are supposed to be laughs.
They're not laughing.
And it's the coldest room. So if you're already doing a scene that doesn't need laughs, I always thought, oh, well, that's got to be way easier because you're not expecting anything from them.
Well, I think in general that's what makes drama easier than comedy, because comedy, it doesn't work if nobody's laughing. It doesn't matter how good you were.
Right.
You know, nobody laughed. So comedy is a different animal and a tricky one, and one that's really interesting. But I don't know. I remember the rooms just feel like there's no air in them, you know, and it is a brutal process and has nothing to do with acting, really. That's the weird thing, is all these hoops are set up and in a way have nothing to do with what you're going to do when you show up and do your work. So you'd think that they'd find a way to do it so that you'd really get the best people for the job. But that's not the way it goes.
No, and especially now. Just auditioning like now is probably terrible if you're testing, because now people have their phones to rifle through. You're not even looking up. Like, it used to just be cold. Now it's cold and you're not even paying attention.
Right. I remember I had an audition for a commercial early on, and this was in New York, so that's when I was starting. And it was for a might have been for a soda. wasn't a beer, but I think it was a soda, and you had to dance. They wanted to see you dance. And I remember there was like a rug, you know, like a rug you could hear.
Yeah.
And they had a boombox, but the boombox was not loud, you know. It was like boom, 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 boom. And I was in a bathing suit. And it's middle of winter, New York, going for a soda commercial on the beach that they're going to shoot somewhere beautiful. And I go, and you know, you had to bring a bathing suit. So, you know, I'm in a bathing suit. And I remember I'm like dancing and I'm having many, many thoughts. One of them is, you left Yale for this. And the other is, what's that sound? Those are my thighs. I can actually hear my thighs as I'm dancing. It's that quiet in here.
And they're just analyzing you the whole time.
It's that quiet. The music is so soft that I can actually hear my feet on the rug and, oh, that's my thighs too.
Oh, yeah. Commercial auditions, I think they're the culmination of every nightmare that people have about having to get up in front of people and speak.
Right.
Those are commercial auditions where you have to do the most.
Because they're like, just be goofy.
Yeah, just have fun with it. Have fun. Well, what am I supposed to do? I'm going to turn the camera on. You just have fun. Like, the casting associate doesn't give two fucks about whatever's happening. He just needs to cycle you through as quickly as possible.
Just have fun with it is the worst direction.
Just have fun. There's a room full of other dudes out there in bathing suits. We're having fun. Yeah.
You know what I hear when somebody says just have fun? I hear, you don't look like you're having any fun.
I hear, listen, this is awful, so you need to just get through it somehow. Right. So just have fun. Just have fun with it.
Make this bearable for one of us.
I could never get around my own self-critic.
It's hard.
To effectively audition for commercials, because I always just felt like, this is dumb. I'm dumb at it. There are people who are
better
at this.
They would want you to improvise, you know, a lot at those commercial auditions, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it had very little to do with what the commercial was actually going to be, I think, ultimately. I never saw a commercial where guys were dancing in their bathing suits.
It was a commercial for H&R Block. They had nothing to do with anything.
Exactly.
I never saw
that commercial.
Come to think of it.
It was actually just set up by a wealthy, horny socialite.
Well, that sadly, I believe that happens, you know, with women. I do believe that there's a certain amount of producers out there that like to hold auditions for movies that are never going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And they just bring in the... Yeah, yeah. It's a creepy, creepy business. I mean, at best, it's a creepy business. Yeah. At best, you feel like, oh, I'm really exposing myself in a weird way, and it's odd. Then the dark side of that is infinitely worse.
Well, I guess I should feel lucky that when I was doing these things, it was before everything was of record.
Mm. Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, I'm sure whatever tape there is of me dancing around in that studio has long been lost or erased, or
it would have been up somewhere.
I fucking hope so.
Yeah.
but these days, Jesus, everything lasts forever. It's awful.
Yeah, it's a strange... I mean, having been on both sides of the social media explosion, having had a career on both sides of it, it must have started to seem so odd when that happened. You're like, wow, everyone's talking about a lot of weird stuff. Like, you used to kind of be able to exist somewhat in a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really like that anymore.
No, I remember very distinctly walking down the street in New York. I don't know how many years ago. It's got to be at least 10 or 12. I was like, everybody's really proud of their phones. They're all showing me their phones. Like, I didn't know there was cameras in the phones. Like, yeah, it's weird. I was wondering, everybody's like, hey, look, I got a phone. Like, no, that's a good-looking phone. A lot of people are proud of their phones. It's very interesting.
They were just capturing your image. The entire world. I mean, it used to just be the tabloids, and now the entire world has become a tabloid because everyone wants to dissect and talk about everything, and there's no
the whole relationship to photography has changed, too.
Oh, sure.
you used to ask somebody if you could take their picture. You know, it was like an invasion, and it is. But there was an etiquette about it.
Yeah.
Like, and not just somebody that's famous, but like if you liked the way a stranger looked, or you liked their house, or whatever, you would. This is an intimate thing. I'm asking, can I take a picture of your things or you? But no.
Where I did an architecture project in school, and we wanted to take a picture of certain houses, like certain architectural styles.
Right.
And it was, I'd knock on the door and ask, right, can I take a picture? But like now, I feel like, fuck it.
you just take like burst shoot, just take 10 photos, put them on Instagram.
Can you get back in the house? I'm ruining my shot.
Sir, please. This is a private moment.
Drag a Victorian without you in it? Come on, asshole. It's a nice porch. Get off it.
I hadn't really thought about that. I never really thought about that before, but yeah, because there used to be so much of a production behind stand over there when it's like, okay, everyone stands. Now it's just la 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 la, because you don't have to.
Yeah, but it was like literally me walking around the neighborhood and like knock on the door, and I'd say, hey, I'm taking it. I'd say, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Not now.
Fuck it.
Yeah, everyone feels like they have a right to everything, all information at all times. Everyone has a right to it.
Well, and I guess they do. You know, everybody has a right to everything. I guess that's true, but I feel like...
That's the Mulder in you talking.
You know, I guess because I grew up in a different time, I kind of, you know, I yearn for that sense a little more. And I don't mean distance just as a person whose face is known. I just mean distance, period.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shandling spoke at your thing, right?
Yeah.
How'd he do? Did he kill?
Yeah, he always does. He's there's nobody funnier than Gary Shandling.
He's so funny. You know, I've met him twice. Mm-hmm. Both times, oddly crusty. And I felt like it...
You gotta crack through it.
That's the thing. There are defense shields. I've not successfully cracked... I met him at... Sarah Silverman at a party last year, and he was there, and someone introduced me to him, and he goes, it's Chris. And he's like, what do you do? And I go, oh, I'm a comedian. I'm a stand-up. I host a couple. And he goes, I got it. And then he walked away. And I'm like, oh, you asked me. What? I'm not trying to pitch you anything. You asked me.
It's a good story. I got it is good.
I literally said like four words. I'm a stand-up. And I got it. I'm like, oh, okay. Well,
that's pretty great.
Nice to see you. Did you guys meet because of the Larry Sanders Show?
Yeah. Yeah. I really wanted to be on the show. That was... It began when I was doing the X-Files, and I used to get the VHS tapes of it sent to me up in Canada because I was obsessed with it, and it was
groundbreaking.
I thought this guy was amazing. It was. I mean, you can trace cable television's ascendance to that show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the first show that is doing television in a way where people go, oh shit. This is better than anything out there. This is more real. This is funnier. This is smarter.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that, you know, because cable was smaller back then. Didn't have the numbers or the awards.
But it had the freedom.
It still does in a way, but like, you know, Gary used to get nominated for Cable Ace Awards, you know, not Emmys, when now he'd be winning all the Emmys.
Oh, absolutely.
But back then, you know, Cable Ace, and maybe towards the end of the run, Emmys finally started to...
Yeah, Tambor's got enough.
Started to acknowledge the show, but started to acknowledge cable, I would say mostly because of Sanders.
I mean, there are so many things that people listening have not seen. I assume everyone's seen the Larry Sanders Show, but if you haven't, you should watch it so you can see how many things are derivative of, and like people still pitch shows and they're like, well, it's kind of a Larry Sanders take. Right. And I think some of the times people pitching haven't even seen the Larry Sanders Show.
Right.
They just know it's like show within a show, docu-style comedy.
Right. But also just the idea of the celebrity cameo, which is pervasive. I like to think, you know, Gary and I did the man crush thing early. You know, now everything's a man crush.
Mm-hmm.
Inside show business, that kind of stuff. But the thing about Sanders is it's just so human. You know, Gary was so painstakingly real, you know, in the way he ran that show. And... There's no cheap jokes, you know. There's great jokes, but and they all come from character. You know, it wasn't like sitcom setup joke. It was like the jokes arose from the character, not the jokes.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking, well, I've never seen a show like this, and I just had had my agent manager call and say, you know, they have any interest in having me play a guy named me. And yeah, so I got the call that I could go do it, and they sent me a script, and I was like, okay, that's great. And I just met Gary to work with him. He had no clue who I was. It certainly was not his hire. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't know. And I just told the story today, because after he spoke shortly about me, I had to speak about me at this Walk of Fame thing. And I did a scene with Gary, and it's all very casual, like two cameras, and they're both kind of swinging around like documentary style. And it wasn't the way I was used to working at all. I was used to working much more cinematic, like X-Files, like shooting a movie, you know, traditional. And it was quick, and I didn't know so much was going around. And I did a take, a couple takes. Gary turns, and he looked at me, and he goes, "How old are you?" And I said, "I'm 33. He goes, "What took you so long?" You know, and I was like, "Wow, all right,
that's really cool."
Yeah, it was like the weirdest compliment and the best compliment coming from him. And after that,
it's very hard to get a compliment out of that guy. Right. Mostly, it's just I get it.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, and I said, and after I told that story today, Gary said to me, "I was going to tell that story," and I said, "Well, I'm glad you didn't, because that would have sucked. Because then I would have had nothing to say."
You could talk about T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, petrol is a bird, and gasoline.
Here's your PhD.
Flight is energy.
Well, that's kind of shit I was saying.
Yeah, of course.
Had a good day. I got my star on the Walk of Fame and a PhD. Right. It's like typical, yeah. You know, just typical Los Angeles right. day. Mm-hmm. So what now? Like now, are you off from Aquarius? Are you off?
No, I'm shooting Aquarius right now.
You're shooting Aquarius right now.
Yeah.
And how quickly did X-Files come together? How did this iteration of X-Files come together? Because I like
the word iteration. I use that too.
Yeah.
I like iteration.
Well, that's what it is. Like, it's just, yeah.
I'm not sure what it means, but I like it.
this version of...
Because I really don't like reboot.
It's not a reboot at all.
I just don't like that word.
You know, it doesn't count. It's a reboot. You guys are all in it. Like it's,
you know, honestly...
Can you explain to me what a reboot is?
A reboot would be if they recast the show and they change the graphics and they, you know...
But literally, what does it mean to reboot?
It means to start something over, an old property.
No, on
over.
A computer?
On a computer, you start it over. Like you turn it off and turn it on again. Huh. You're rebooting, you're power cycling, you're starting it over, you're freshening. You know, because when you reboot your machine, it closes down all the processes that you don't need, and it just starts it fresh.
All right, so it's not a reboot.
No. It's not a reboot at all. To me, it felt like, oh, this is just an X-Files. Like, they just picked up, you know, like...
You got Mitch Pileggi, it's not a reboot.
He would get mad at me, it's Pileggi.
Oh, damn it.
You know, I always say, like, you know, if you're going to lose your hair, do it young, because you will look the same age for like 50 years.
That's what my mother always said. She said, "David, if you're going to lose your hair, like it's a choice."
I was going to do it this weekend. Should I not do it? But Mitch still looks, you know, like he just had a little bit of beard, but he looks pretty much the same.
He's a handsome bald man.
He's a very handsome man. But it didn't, to me, it just felt like, a little bit of time had passed, but it's basically like they've picked it up.
Right.
And seeing Joel McHale as a conservative pundit is hilarious to me.
I know,
well,
right?
That's accurate.
Matt, you're making a serious face.
Just hope you can hear that through the microphone.
Yeah, how do you do that? Irony is dangerous, very dangerous.
So, but I think the thing that was so great about having it come back is that it really felt like by the fans, for the fans. So many of our friends, you know, like Kumail, who does X-Files Files, and then hearing that you guys on a break when he was shooting, which I know was the literally probably the greatest moment of his life. And, you know, he's on probably the best comedy on television
right
now. And he's a brilliant stand-up. But I know doing that, I was so excited for him to get to do that. And then you guys, like in the middle of the night, go into a tent or a trailer and just talk and then like podcast.
It was a tent.
For like 20 minutes.
It was not a trailer.
20 minutes or 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. We were just like, he's like, can I record this? I'm like, yeah, let's talk about those shows that we hate. You know, let's talk about all the X-Files that we don't like. So we started doing that. I didn't hear the podcast, and I hope we weren't too dismissive of some of the shows that we didn't like. But
that's amazing.
We had a fun time, and he's a great guy, and I love their show. I love Mike Judge, and I love that show.
I got to listen to it now. If you guys are going through episodes, like, oh.
But he might have like gone over that part and just used later on when we maybe talked about stuff that we did like.
Well, I think that's what's so funny when you're on a show that becomes like a force in fandom, and people see the show as very linear, but you as the performer, it's just. I would imagine it's like you're living in your short-term memory because you have to get through shit tons of pages every day.
Right.
And then next episode. So people are like, what happened in episode? And you're like, did we do that? I don't even know. Did you watch the show?
At first I did. I used to watch it. First few years probably I watched it. And then not as religiously after that. But you forget a fair amount. I remember strange things, you know, it's like life. Like, why do I remember getting a popsicle with my uncle when I was 8 and I don't remember, you know, my 5th birthday party?
Right.
You know, like, shit that they really made an effort to make special for me. And I remember this crap moment. Something is encoded in there that we, as humans, we don't know why. We don't know why we remember that. So making shows a little like that. It's like, no, I don't remember that great episode. I remember... like what I had for lunch that day when we were shooting that episode. Yeah, lunch was really good that day.
Yeah.
You're welcome, fans. I hope you enjoy this look into the process.
It was a flank steak. We ate it out of a truck.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I went home and I fell asleep, and it was a good day.
I mean, when you're on a show and you know, like, this is going for a while, I should be happy, I should be thankful this is going on. But then at a certain point, particularly like 7 years is a long time to do a show. And then you start feeling like, I kind of want to explore other things. I want to explore like how much of the struggle do you feel like, I don't want to be disrespectful because I'm lucky to have a job, but creatively I really kind of feel like I've done this guy and I want to go do other stuff.
Well, it's hard for people to relate to, you know, people that have normal everyday struggles, you know, when they listen to actors complain about getting paid so much.
Right.
Having such terrific lives and how hard it is for them. So
they did not have the cut of meat at the lunch truck anymore, and I just couldn't take it.
Right. So it's you get it. It's ultimately it's not a hard life, but if you chose a creative path in life and you chose to be an actor, you chose to be a creative person, that's really what you chose to do. At least in my case, I didn't choose to be on one show. That wasn't like my dream. That wasn't what I got into it for. I didn't think, oh, I want to get on a TV show that'll run till I croak, you know. So I chose to a creative life, and at a certain point after 7 years, I think I started to feel a little less creative, you know, and I just thought it was fair at that point to say, hey, let's all take stock right now. And you know, we all said this is too hard to do even 5 years. Let's quit after 5, you know. But no, we kept going. Then there was like no end in sight. And I was like, well, you know, if I really have my integrity and I say I'm a creative person, it should be no amount of money that should lure me back in a way. I should really go off and see what else is out there for me. That was really my thinking at that point.
Because you've also directed and I know you released an album too.
Yeah, it's not really... But, you know, I realize how from the outside in it can look disrespectful or ungrateful, and maybe it is, but I didn't feel that way. I just felt like I was being honest, and I felt like, at that point I felt like, well, we're going to do the movies. You know, that was always the idea. We're going to continue on and do X-Files movies. So I didn't feel like I was killing the show. You know, I think I would have felt different if I thought I was killing the show. But I thought, oh, you know, we all said we're going to stop the show at some point and do movies. So that was kind of my thinking at that point.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, 20-some years in, I've only seen the first episode. I'm going to watch. Thankfully, Fox sent me. They sent me all 6 of them.
That's what my professor sounded like more. that was a better professor.
Excellent point on the petrol. Wait a minute. Where am I again? Where is Duchovny? We have to give him this doctorate. He's never showed up for it.
I'd have gotten it just for the alliteration of Dr. Duchovny.
Dr. David Duchovny.
That's fucking...
Triple D.
Triple D
is a triple threat.
That would have been... I kind of wanted to see it in the credits. Just starring Dr. Duchovny.
That would have been so amazing. That would have been so amazing.
Or just
amazing.
Dave Duchovny, PhD.
PhD. What? He's a... Are you fucking kidding? But she's... Yeah, I know. He's a
Didn't
doctor.
I see him in a Speedo and an orange juice commercial?
Yeah, yeah. That's
he's
what
got
his,
a PhD.
That was his dissertation. Like,
what
that was
the fuck is wrong with him?
That was the orals. What if you went into the orals in the bathing suit and you're like, listen, I could talk about poetry. I could just... Maybe it's so weird they would go, okay, well, that's artistic.
I thought
in
maybe
some way.
I could.
Gentlemen, if you allow me to have fun with it.
Can I have fun with these orals?
Just have fun.
Maestro, please.
Just have a good time. Listen,
a beat.
I'm going to pitch you a crazy idea, all right? Here's my crazy. You want to talk about reboots?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you're familiar with the Rodney Dangerfield 1987 vehicle Back to School. Mm-hmm. Rodney Dangerfield is a millionaire who goes back to school to get his education because his son's there and he wants to... Okay. 2016.
Back to graduate school.
David Duchovny goes back to graduate school. You make the movie. Now you're a rich and famous actor.
It's more of a reality show, isn't it?
It's a hybrid. Yeah. You're actually getting your PhD while making this broad back-to-college comedy. Now, yeah. I know you're very excited about this.
I am.
Fresh off the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I'm making his serious face right now.
Have you ever thought about writing yourself into just, like, the most opposite type of thing that you could think of for yourself just to do it?
I don't know. I think of parts as being whatever they're going to be creatively. Are they challenging? Stuff like that. But I don't think, like, willfully. I don't have, like, a plan of how I'm going to be perceived in a way that way. So I don't think that I would have. I think if it was, I mean, I guess I'm giving you a sincere answer to maybe a question that wasn't sincere.
No, please.
But I don't know. I mean, I think it would have to do, if I thought the role would be interesting to play in a way. But I don't think of it in terms of like, oh, that's going to be so weird for people that know me from this or from that. Because I don't walk around with that perception in my head of myself. I just kind of walk around unconscious, right? Like most people. So
yeah, just figuring out how to get to the next.
Exactly.
I got to stand over there and I do this, and I got to get home and take a nap. And
so I've never really had like a career, like an overview. I don't have one of those. I don't have that gene.
Do you know if Manson has seen Aquarius?
I sure hope so. Our numbers don't reflect it.
Well, he watched them all online when they first
came
out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then they complained that there weren't enough people watching on TV. Well,
oddly, Manson has a Nielsen box. It's the craziest thing.
I think he likes The Voice, I believe.
Yeah.
I think he was kind of hoping that we were going to be after The Voice.
Well, he's really into the whole Blake and
loves
Gwen Stefani thing.
He was very happy. I know he was specifically upset about all the stuff with Gwen and Gavin.
Yeah, sure.
Gavin Rossdale.
Well, you know,
he loves Bush. Race Blade Suitcase is his favorite album.
Good pull.
Yeah. I think Bush is a good band.
They are a great band.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean Charles Manson has a history of liking good music.
Well,
I mean,
he does. He does, and he's a musician.
Yeah.
And actually, in both our first two seasons, the one we're shooting now, a lot of his storyline has to do with him trying to break into the music business.
Oh, wow.
And become bigger than the Beatles. That was the idea. He was going to be bigger than the Beatles. We just didn't know exactly how he
Yeah,
pull
in
that
a way.
Out.
I mean, I guess, you know.
All right. As a solo act.
No, he had a group.
Yeah, that's true. So there's a lot of music around the show, and some original Manson music, I believe, is in the show. Certainly the lyrics, Cease to Exist, is one song.
Wow.
The Beach Boys recorded a song of his, but didn't give him credit, and there was, you know, that's kind of ballsy if you take a Manson song and he's like, no, you can't have credit.
That's mine. Hey. I'm just going to pretend that he's walking around a jail cell going, got a machine head, like he's just singing songs all day long.
But I think Guns N' Roses or Axl Rose did a cover of a Manson song.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Years ago. You're nodding? Oh, that's Look At You. We have Look At You Game Girl in the show.
Oh, that's
we
awesome.
The Manson character singing that.
Well,
look at your game, girl. That's such a 60s.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like you could get. I feel like you could make a song like it sounds like an R&B slow jam.
It does.
That's probably where he should have.
Look at your game, girl.
Yeah. Opening for Boys to Men, Charles Manson.
All right. God, I hope he never gets out. We're so dead.
I don't think he's gonna.
I feel like he's not coming out.
He's probably. Yeah. I feel like for the swastika on the forehead alone, they'd be like, yeah, he's probably not.
Slap on the wrist.
He learned his lesson. I don't know.
But good of you to do that in a mirror so it looks right.
Yeah, it was pretty. It was talented. I would have gotten it wrong.
I would have gotten it backwards.
Fuck!
I just fucked this whole forehead thing up.
Forgot to account for the reflection.
It's like now red rum.
Now I'm just
red rum.
Buddhist symbol for peace.
Yeah. Man, that's the opposite of what I was trying to say. No one's going to take me seriously.
Well, what is it with the tails? Is it?
Yeah, that's the Buddhist symbol, right?
Right. It's with the tails on it, right? Yeah.
Breathe in, breathe out.
That's not a Raised Boy suitcase, guys. You want swallowed or.
I had no idea what a bush aficionado you turned out to be.
Listen, I was around in the 90s, guys.
I was too, but I don't. I remember when they came out.
Collective Soul?
I wasn't into Collective Soul. No.
Me neither.
No.
It was just a name I remembered.
I had
that one song that go, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Today, Dave Matthews Band announced the new tour dates this year, guys. Sorry.
No.
I'm really excited.
He's shaking his head.
25th anniversary.
You. David, you're going to say something important.
Is it a reboot?
No.
No, same people.
A friend of mine is actually my assistant up in Vancouver. He was very funny. And his answering machine, it was the. Who's the lead singer of Metallica?
James Hetfield.
His was like the James Hetfield answering machine. He'd go, hello. Leave a message after the tone. I'll get back to you when I can.
I don't know if this is true. I wish I had asked them when they were on. I heard this story about how. Maybe there's a recording of it on YouTube, but, you know, he goes, yeah, a lot in the songs.
Yeah.
And the producer was like, hey, James, you want to try mixing it up a little
bit? Have fun with it.
Yeah, basically gave him a have fun with it moment.
Yeah.
So he just, so he's in the song, he's like, woman, is that better? You know, like, okay, just go back.
Oh, is that for real?
That's a for real story that I heard. I don't know if it's for real, but that's an urban legend.
If it exists, it's online.
If it exists, it is online.
Woman.
Although maybe not. It's Metallica. They tend to pull a lot of stuff offline.
We don't know, but I do. We have trapped you here for over an hour, and I want to thank
Turn
you.
Turn the Page, great cover by Metallica.
Yes,
Turn the Page. Yeah,
yeah. Garage Inc. Garage Inc. was the name of that record.
Yes,
yeah.
You are a full.
He's a '90s guy.
Yes, I've been there. You know.
Matt can tell you anything about Star Trek, Star Trek The Next Generation, James Bond.
I can do pretty well with the original Star Trek.
Really?
You want to ask me, I will stay here. You ask me three questions that you think are middling to difficult.
Middling to difficult. Okay, what was Scotty's?
Not like Ben Stiller.
Right. What was Scotty's rank?
I got an easier one.
That's bullshit.
I got an easier one. So on the planet where they were forcing the crew members to fight, what was the currency that they were using to place bets?
Quatloos.
Yes. That's a much easier one.
We actually used Quatloos on Californication.
Oh, you did?
I was like, oh, no, that's too many Quatloos. Something was expensive. I remember there was a scene with my daughter, and she came out with a dress. How many Quatloos is that?
That's fantastic. Okay, that's two. You got a third one?
Make it stuff from an episode, not like what was Scotty's rank.
I mean, he's commander.
What was he? One.
Commander.
By the end or during the
during the run, and he was third in command.
Okay,
when Kirk and Spock are
it's
on
like
the planet.
Secretary of State.
I mean, come on,
Scotty's in control.
Scotty's data.
Yeah.
Let's see something.
Dilithium crystals.
Yep. Sure.
That's an easy one. Everyone knows.
Hey, we in the show last night, unobtainium. Huh?
Unobtainium. So good.
That's bullshit. What is that?
What is it called when Vulcans have to mate every 7 years?
There yes.
There he is.
I answered
there
that before you finished
there
the question.
Is. There he is.
Vulcan puberty. It's very volatile. It's the only time they're really, really emotional.
Okay, what does the old lady say when she wants it over with already? Stop fighting.
Oh, I don't.
Troika.
Matt, he got me.
He got
What's
me.
What's the drink that little baby... all-powerful baby guy.
Oh, Ron Howard's brother, Clint Howard.
Clint Howard!
What does he drink?
Is it all dead? No.
He has like, he toasts them at the end. He's like, I don't remember either.
Damn it.
What is the name of the big lizard creature?
The Gorn.
Yeah, that was easy,
right? That's very easy.
It was too easy.
That was easy. It was very easy.
I love watching you guys bond over Star Trek. This is delightful.
Give me one more. Give me one more. I'm feeling good.
What? All right, here's one. What
is the Nerdist?
What class?
Yeah.
I came prepared. I studied last night.
You did a very good job. I'm going to give you a PhD at the end of this.
What class of starship was the Enterprise?
No, you see, look, you didn't learn your lesson.
It said many
times. I'm not into the military.
It's on a plaque.
I'm not
into
that shit.
It's a galaxy-class starship.
Nope, that's the D. The D is a galaxy-class. Right. The Enterprise is a...
Hold on. It's a starship.
It is a starship,
Starship Enterprise.
Yes, but it is a class of starship.
D? I don't know.
It's a Constitution class.
Now he wants a question about an episode.
Yes.
Okay.
Going all this military shit.
Military shit. God, I'm trying to think of one that's like decently.
Bonk bonk on the head.
That's a good one. Okay. What is the name of the grain in The Trouble with Tribbles?
Yes, I know that. Yes.
Duchovny is going into a trance-like state.
Quattro criticalium. Quattro.
So close.
Quattro criticali.
You're transposing some letters here. Quadro?
Quadro. Give it to me.
Quadro triticale.
But you know what?
That was so good. I gotta give it to him.
He's gonna get the PhD.
Because, you know, if the closed captioning people
petrol.
Were writing it out,
petrol.
That made up for the petrol thing. Yeah. That made up for the petrol thing.
Right.
And also, oddly enough, someone today just emailed me a thing of all the times Vince Gilligan put references to X-Files and Breaking Bad. There's morally... I never get to break out my Vince Gilligan impersonation.
It's nobody knows how good that is.
Well, thanks, David. It's really great. It's really great to be Vince Gilligan.
That is very good.
He, but the morally cigarettes and all that, like, just rampant through Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
So you are also connected to that show.
Yeah, well, Bryan Cranston came and he did an episode called Drive... where this is before Malcolm in the Middle, so I don't know where he got Brian from, but I just auditioned for the part, I guess, and Vince had written that episode, so I guess that's where Brian and Vince first met.
Yeah, I think that's where they first met. Brian had been around for a long time, like kind of failed sitcom after fail, and there's like, you know, if you're around, if you work hard and you're
around
long enough,
true. Brian is the exception.
Yeah,
that really doesn't happen. It's pretty amazing the career that he's found.
Yeah.
You know, so you can say like keep at it, but it's really the exception to the rule that a guy makes it at that age after, you know. So it's quite an amazing thing he's done. But then Malcolm in the Middle came, and then, you know, his career is very interesting. He's been tonally in very different pieces. He's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think, you know, every time stuff like that happens and people, it just sort of widens the scope of the industry to not put people in boxes and go, this person who did a broad comedy could now maybe do a really serious drama.
You would think, but I think with television now that happens because people get to go out and they do these, they can really stretch out in cable and take chances. Whereas in movies, there's so much money riding on just one shot that people tend more to go with sure things because, you know, you don't get another shot in a movie.
Or you do six episodes of X-Files, and how many Quatlers did they pay?
Yeah, they paid me in Quatlers.
Well, thank you for
all
being
your Quatlers are vesting right now.
half in Quatlers, half in Bitcoin.
Oh, you're fine then. Yeah, you're totally fine. It's going to be great.
Okay.
Well, enjoy your burrito, everyone. Thank you, David Duchovny, for
thank
being
you.
Here. Congratulations.
Right. Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this, perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients, popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.